for Trump country is the damage already done.
For this Democrat to win in this part of Trump country.
That is Trump country, and I think the pain is going to start filtering up.
What you might call Trump country. We're talking North Dakota.
This is a state, West Virginia, that really is the heart of Trump country.
That's not Trump country.
It's been almost 2 years since the presidential election, when the media's fixation on the idea of so-called Trump country began. But when it comes to the intersection of race and class and politics, what are we still getting wrong? I put that question to Sarah Smarsh. She's a journalist born and raised on a farm in Kansas, and she recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called "Liberal Blind Spots Are Hiding the Truth About Trump Country."
The point of my piece was to challenge this concept that there is this broad swath of the country that is monolithically conservative in politics and culture. So while, you know, there have been some sort of fashionable and controversial calls for empathy or compassion for people with far-right views or Trump supporters, I'm far less interested in that than I am in shining a light on the millions of people, and that's working class and all classes of people of all colors, who are not Trump supporters, who have been kind of rendered invisible by the way that we create this map of red and blue squares and this electoral college that leads to very reductive media narratives about red and blue America, Trump country, and the more liberal locations. It's much more complicated than that, of course. And in places like Kansas, which is thought of as deep red, you know, in the 2016 presidential election, I think it was like 36% of voters voted for Hillary Clinton. So they are just suddenly wiped off the map when then we discuss who won the state. But 30 to 40% of Americans at all socioeconomic rungs and all colors in red states ain't nothing.
You talk a lot about your father in the piece. Tell us a little bit about him and why you decided to include his story.
Yeah, well, I guess my father kind of exemplifies my family. He's a lifelong construction worker, a white man who has rural roots. He grew up on a farm, and he's now a traveling construction worker based in Wichita, Kansas. By and large, his views correlate with, I would say, like the left wing of the Democratic Party right now. Now, he is a guy who, over the years, I'm sure has fluctuated in and out of also some conservative elements of thinking. Rural America has a deep strain of awareness about government, or quote-unquote big government. And that's a kind of old-fashioned strain in that realm of American politics that doesn't have to or doesn't necessarily intersect with the really toxic, racist, xenophobic social conservatism that we see rising today. So,
which has been the real focus. And in fact, it's been a struggle to get the media to really call some of the more abhorrent behavior that we're seeing what it is, right? Racist or xenophobic or what have you. At the same time, I guess I wonder what your thoughts are on this. It feels as though the media has covered the white working class, and I'm putting that in quotes as well, but they're only covering the white working class when it reflects the worst of society. Is that part of your argument?
I think that maybe just at the human level, members of the media who are also members of this society, like the rest of the country, seeks to find a clear villain, like who did this? Who put this guy in office? And from my vantage, it was white people. That's the answer. And it was white people at every socioeconomic rung. Where the class and the classism comes into this discussion is that suddenly, you know, within that group, the piece of it that doesn't have a voice, that can't speak for itself, is the working class and those in poverty. And they have just sort of been scapegoated, I guess.
Now, there are a lot of people who will probably read the piece and or listen to this segment and will say, and these numbers are necessarily true, across the board, white Americans, whether they're poor, working class, middle class, will often and almost always in every measure of society do better than Black Americans and largely than Latino Americans. So how do you see being able to change the perception of poor whites when they still seem to be benefiting more than poor Black and brown Americans?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is there's no denying that they benefit more than Black and Brown Americans. And two things can be true at once. You know, so I, growing up in poverty, working in fields and doing manual labor growing up, I at once was economically disadvantaged and also racially privileged. And so absolutely owning and admitting that the very clear fact in this country that the fact that I'm a white person benefited me probably in ways that I will never even know.
What are the media missing when they continue to focus on the white working class in this sort of myopic view?
That narrative is destructive for all of us as Americans, regardless of where we live, in that that story allows the perfectly well-educated, well-informed, middle and upper-class white Americans who voted for him in droves to just basically get off scot-free. I mean, and it's mind-boggling to me that we see news stories of, you know, Los Angeles, New York City, attorneys, professors, white people who have every privilege in the world caught berating people of color in public or on a train or calling the cops because they were barbecuing while black. It's like we see those stories, and yet the narrative is so entrenched that Bubba out in the country is the last bastion of racism in this country that it's like cognitive dissonance in media discourse. I feel like, yeah, I'm pushing back against this narrative out of wanting to just provide a corrective for the sake of accuracy as a journalist, but also because you're undermining progress and that movement in this country if you are invalidating or ignoring or denying the hard work on the ground fighting white supremacy, misogyny, homophobia, all sorts of elements of that have taken hold at the state level in a lot of these states that we call red. People in places like where I'm from have been resisting, quote unquote, for years. And, you know, frankly, I think it's just like that work is some of the most crucial and brave within the movement in many ways for being a political minority.
Sarah Smarsh is a writer, and her forthcoming book is called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.